Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the invitation. Before I talk about weed management per se, I thought it might be worthwhile to sort of give an overview of global climate change. And what I'm about to do is to take an entire semester of understanding global climate change and condense it down into 2 minutes. So the phrase bare bones doesn't really do justice to this. So let me try that. Okay, the key to understanding global climate change is not so much understanding that carbon dioxide is rising, but it's really understanding water vapor. There are two principal greenhouse gases, water vapor and carbon dioxide. In those areas on the globe where water vapor is high, and that is where it's warm, wet, and humid along the equatorial regions, adding carbon dioxide isn't going to change the surface temperature very much because water vapor is, in fact, the dominant greenhouse gas. Now, flip that around. Where is the air dry? Doesn't hold a lot of water vapor, and therefore adding more CO2 will have a disproportionate effect with respect to surface temperature. So that's going to be where the air is cold, doesn't hold a lot of water vapor, and so the poles, and that's where we see the greatest relative increase in terms of surface temperatures. Where else is the air dry? Well, obviously in deserts. So we expect to see increasing desertification. That is that because there's not a lot of water vapor, adding more CO2 is going to cause a greater increase in terms of surface temperatures. And of course, in terms of altitude, as you go up in elevation, there's less water vapor, and therefore CO2 is going to have a disproportional effect with respect to that. Wow, that was easy. Okay, good. So the physical consequences of all that is that less temperature increases where water vapor is high, and more precipitation. So we see that greater temperature increases with latitude or altitude as you go towards the poles or you go up in elevation. We expect to see an increase in temperature, increasing desertification, increasing frequency of drought, and of course rising sea levels from increasing polar and glacier melt. Now that's sort of the physical consequences of global climate change. Let me try and look for a moment, if you will, for the biological consequences, and those relate to CO2 and plant biology. Now all of you know from sort of botany 101 that carbon dioxide is in fact a source of carbon for all plants to grow, and often this is sort of diluted down into a simple phrase, CO2 is plant food. So we understand that there are basically four resources that plants need from the physical environment. They need light, they need water, they need nutrients. You don't necessarily need soil, but you do need nutrients. And of course, you need carbon dioxide. About 95% of all plant species lack the optimal amount of carbon dioxide that they need to grow. So this idea that CO2 is plant food is also a consequence of rising CO2 in addition to any physical consequences with respect to temperature. So the increase in CO2 will, and of and by itself, have rapid implications with respect to global plant biology. And you can go to this website. This is sponsored by the Fossil Fuel Association, but it's for loblolly pine, showing how loblolly pine is responding or can respond to rising CO2 levels from 385 parts per million on the left to 835 parts per million on the right. So yay, loblolly pine. Wow, great. This is great. Wonderful. There is, of course, a small little hitch on this, and that is that CO2 is not a very smart molecule. It doesn't just stimulate the growth of those plants that you find desirable in human society. It also stimulates the growth of things like poison ivy. And when you see how CO2 can affect the growth of poison ivy, then you will get a sense of how it changes in terms of both its production, leaf production, but also in terms of its oil production, erythritol, which is the oil that causes contact dermatitis. So, as in fact occurs, there was a inadvertent experiment where loblolly pine and poison ivy actually grew in competition. And to sort of give you an overview of that, this is back in the Duke Forest back in the 1990s when the Department of Energy had lots of money and they were sponsoring Duke to set up this very large array of standpipes that were blowing CO2 into the center of the loblolly pine forest. And the idea was to see, by stimulating the growth of loblolly pine, and you saw that loblolly pine can respond very well to CO2, how much of that additional CO2 that was being added was going to be taken up by the loblolly pine. Cool. The problem was that, in fact, of all the different species that were responding to the rise in CO2, the understory species, poison ivy, was, in fact, the species that showed the overall strongest response. So in In relative terms, the winner in this instance was, in fact, poison ivy. And I thank Jackie Moen, who's now at the University of Georgia, for sharing her photos of poison ivy with me. So in the terms of the second consequence of rising CO2 levels in addition to temperature, and that is CO2 is a fundamental resource for plant growth. Not all plants are beneficial to human society. Not all plants respond the same way to a resource. And that rising CO2 will alter qualitative components of plant biology as well. That was probably 4 minutes, but I tried. Okay, so you get an overview of the consequences of global climate change and rising CO2 levels. Now let's look at that in the consequence of weed management. What does it mean for weed biology? We'll break this down into sort of three main categories: monitor, mitigate, and manage. So let's look at monitoring for the moment, and the idea that climate and CO2 are going to alter when and where weeds will spread. So your weeds are not going to be your grandfather's weeds. As the climate changes, as CO2 changes, we're going to see major changes with respect to weeds and other pest demography, where they can grow and how quickly they will become established. So I'm going to start with kudzu. I love kudzu. I'm a crazy person, but I think this is like the quintessential invasive weed. If there was a magazine on invasive weeds, this would be the front cover every single time. So we're going to look at it from sort of a long-term perspective of how warming temperatures have affected the rate and spread of kudzu. I'm going to go back in time to the late 1960s and the early 1970s and look at data that was established by Clyde Reed, who was a USDA scientist. And he did this based on field observation and reports from Extension on where kudzu was growing back in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And that line that you see there throughout the Midwestern U.S., that's the northern limit of where kudzu was found as of really that time period. And we wanted to focus on how temperature could affect the spread of kudzu, in part and we chose the Midwest in part because we didn't want to deal with mountain ranges, we didn't want to deal with major urban centers as sort of throwing off where the temperature increases might be occurring. So it was pretty straightforward, and we wanted to ask the question, are warming winters contributing to northward migration of kudzu? Remember that variation between water vapor and CO2? Well, in wintertime in North America, of course, the air is cold, doesn't hold a lot of water vapor, and what we see is that winters are warming faster than summers for that reason. Okay. So how is it moving forward? Now, I should mention that this is work that was done in part by Heather Coyner, who looked at various populations of kudzu that have been introduced into the United States at various times, because there is some variation in kudzu populations. And what she found was that the thermal limit for kudzu was minus 28 degrees Celsius, which is pretty damn cold. So one day exposure to minus 28 would kill any of the kudzu populations that have been introduced into the United States. So that was our baseline thermal control. So we looked at various minimum temperatures throughout the Midwest, and here's some of the data that you see here from Nebraska, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Western Pennsylvania. And we looked at the lowest recorded temperature for that year beginning back in the early 1970s, which is when Clyde Reed established the northernmost limit of kudzu. And you can see that there was, in fact, a fairly consistent occurrence of that threshold temperature throughout the 1970s, throughout the 1980s. And beginning around the mid-1990s, that started to change. That is, that temperature started to become warmer. And those lines are essentially the 95% confidence interval. So by the mid-2000s, in all of these different locations, the temperature had now warmed up enough so that kudzu could, in fact, become established. So if we look in time, and you see now the 2006 line, that is now the northern limit of where kudzu is currently growing. And we think that's due in part to this climate-induced release of this minimum temperature threshold for kudzu. Now, the next question, of course, is how will it change in the future? And we chose an arbitrary 45-degree north line. That's pretty much where we are, I think, now in Minneapolis, yes? So we went through this 45-degree line, and we asked ourselves the question, at these locations, how quickly is the winter temperature changing, and at what point will that temperature reach be warm enough for kudzu to become established? So here's data from Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ontario. And again, you see the same sort of minimum temperature change, that is, beginning in the 1990s, it's starting to go up, starting to go up. And I know you're not supposed to extrapolate in modeling. This is back when my high school math teacher would be pulling his hair out if I told him I was using extrapolation as a means of prediction. But we did this and asked where cuts it would be along this line and near the various dates, 2022, 2019. And because of the lake effect around Michigan, we predicted 2015 for that. Now that's the date at which there's less than a 5% chance of that location experiencing a temperature below minus 28 degrees Celsius. And if you now fast forward to 2011, this dashed line is now the northern limit of Kudzu. And, ta-da, drum roll please, if you go from the EDD maps, which is run out of Georgia, early detection map system, these are all the counties where Kudzu is now showing up. Each county is lit up in green. And if you can look a little more closely at the 45 degree north line, in Benzie County, Michigan, as of last year, they got their first occurrence of kudzu. So, yay, thank you, Benzie County, Michigan. So, in fact, that's where we, based on our 2015 estimate of where it would be, showing up in Michigan at the 45-degree north line. So now kudzu is in Michigan. I'm sure Alabama is not going to lose any sleep over the fact that kudzu is exactly. So, in summing this up and looking at the monitoring aspect of this, that is that climate change and CO2 are going to alter the basic demographics of where weeds can occur. As the winter's temperatures warm, kudzu appears to be expanding since the 1970s. We would postulate that other pests, nothing exceptional about kudzu, but that weeds, insects, and disease, et cetera, are also going to be moving in response to climate. To our knowledge, there is no systematic monitoring currently in place to measure this movement. The climate change and movement of invasive pests, for example, pine bark beetle. Pine bark beetle is sensitive also to winter temperatures. We know that pine bark beetle is devastating large amounts of various forests in the western U.S. 2 years ago, pine bark beetle jumped from the western side. It moved northward enough into Canada. It had jumped from the western to the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains. If you go up far enough in Canada, you know there's boreal forests connecting the eastern and western forests. That forest now slopes to the southeast. There's nothing stopping it from now moving southeast to eastern forests, but no one, to my knowledge, is actually monitoring it. Let me move now very quickly to what we call the mitigate part of the strategy. That is, as climate change alters the spread, there is a impetus for vigilance. You're seeing that where new weeds are going to come into your area, recognizing that they are new weeds and to mitigate them accordingly. This follows pretty much an invasion curve, that is, looking at the area that is infested over time. And control is really efficacious if you can catch something early on. And in the case of kudzu, let me see if I can sort of illustrate that photographically. This is a kudzu plant. This is also a kudzu plant. This is very easy to control. This is much more difficult to control. So a key part of this overall strategy is to make sure that as the climate is moving things around, that you are extra vigilant in terms of keeping track of where these weeds are showing up, because in one case it's very easy to control, but when it reaches this particular stage, it's much harder to control. And then finally, I want to turn a little bit to management. In the United States, in terms of looking at weed management, we do a very effective job of managing weeds through chemical means. And in most developed countries, the primary means of pest control or weed control is through chemical management. And this is for glyphosate as of 2012. These are data from the USDA showing that overall for the U.S., we apply about 180 million pounds of glyphosate each year in order to control weeds. So in the context of this, how will rising CO2 and or climate alter chemical management? By stimulating plant growth, can rising CO2 alter chemical efficacy of weed control. Now, I've shown you two pictures here. The picture on the left is Canada thistle after being sprayed with glyphosate at the recommended dosage, at the manufacturer's recommended dosage. We got between 85 and 90% control. Pretty good. The Canada thistle on the right was also sprayed with the recommended dosage. We got zero control. The reason is because the plants growing on the right were in fact grown under a higher CO2 concentration of around 700 parts per million. And I'll explain why the difference is in a moment. But I want to show you that it isn't just Canada thistle. Here's a long list of publications and associated with a given weed species, the photosynthetic pathway, the herbicide used, and whether or not there was a change in efficacy. And while there isn't always a change, in the majority of cases we do see that rising CO2 per se can in fact have a consequence with respect to how well a given chemistry can control the weed. If we look at not just monocultures of Canada thistle, but we look at it in competition with soybean, in no-till soybean, Canada thistle is often a pernicious weed. So what we did was set up a multi-year experiment where we looked at above-ground biomass of soybean and seed yield of soybean with and without Canada thistle. And at the beginning of each growing season, we would spray it with glyphosate for Canada thistle control, which resulted in pretty good control of Canada thistle, at least initially. We didn't see any significant effects until the third year going in. But in each case, as you gave more CO2, and that's the dark line there, the ambient plus 300 parts per million CO2, the seed yield declined to the point where after 3 years, we were seeing about a 50% loss in soybean seed yield under elevated CO2 as a consequence of Canada thistle competition, even with glyphosate application. Now, why does Canada thistle still able to grow after you apply it with glyphosate? Well, here is our 3 years worth of data looking at the ratio of elevated to ambient CO2 and looking at the extent of shoot stimulation versus root stimulation. And the value of one means, of course, no effect. A value of two means a doubling. And what we found was that, yes, CO2 is plant food, but where the plant grows in response to CO2 can be very different. In the case of Canada thistle, most of that additional growth happened in the consequence of root growth. That is, roots responded to a much greater extent than the shoot. Now, why is that important? Well, because in the case of Canada thistle, even a small part of the root, if it doesn't die, is able to regrow. And so what happened was that you were simply seeing a dilution effect based on the recommended dosage, which did not account for the CO2 stimulation of root growth. Now, can you still control Canada thistle if you up the dosage or increase the number of sprayings? Yes, you can. But there are, of course, economic and environmental consequences of that as well. So in terms of weed management implications, rising CO2 may reduce herbicide efficacy. The basis of the reduction is likely to be species-specific. That is, I'm not going to suggest that what we see in Canada thistle is what other researchers are reporting in terms of a resistance strategy. There's little known regarding the impact of climate and or CO2 on other means of weed or pest control. And I would offer this idea that CO2 of climate is likely to alter basic aspects of plant pest biology, including gene transfer, fitness, and distribution. So some thoughts on management overall. Monitoring is important because forewarned is forearmed, and the past is no longer prologue. What you have been used to in terms of having a certain pest population is likely to change as a consequence of a changing climate and or rising CO2. Mitigation, being proactive is better than being reactive. Scouting out your field, knowing what's there, keeping track of it, even if it seems inconsequential, can be very important. And finally, management. There are many tools in the toolbox. IPM was talked about in the last talk. I think IPR is also a good strategy going forward. But the turning to a chemical in every single case may not be the best strategy. I think we need to think beyond that box and see what other tools are available. And finally, if you'd like to find out a little bit more about this, there is an article by myself and Laura McConnell. Laura is a scientist with Bayer in North Carolina, and we put together this in sort of a more detailed form, and that's in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry, if you'd like to read more about it. And at this point, thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
We've got time for a couple of questions for Lewis.
That's a good question. Kudzu can move through a number of means. Often it can be found on vehicles just as a passenger. So often farm machinery, when it moves to one part of the field to another, can have a bit of kudzu. And because it can reproduce asexually, even a small stem or bit of kudzu, once it lands into a field, can grow and reproduce. Yes,
since kudzu is an alternate host for soybean rust, does that mean that will become a major disease in the upper Midwest in another 10 years?
The honest answer is I don't know. But if you were to look at the temperature part of this, the temperature range for soybean rust is warmer than the temperature range for kudzu establishment. So right now, while I show the movement of kudzu moving northward, the movement of soybean rust is being closely monitored. It is moving, but not nearly as quickly as kudzu is moving.
Any other questions? We're at the break, but I have one other just brief comment that relates back to the question that Tim just asked, and that is that, you know, when we start looking at some of the integration of Lewis's talk and the question that Tim asked about, you know, this relationship between being an alternate host for rust and these things moving, you know, long gone are the days of the simple questions, and I think a lot of us as scientists have known that, and that as we look at long-term research and long-term agricultural research, these synergies among scientists and some of these other pieces, at least in my mind's eye, and I've been kind of cloudy sometimes, so bear with me, but these things make sense to me, and I hope for those of you that have been here the majority of the morning can kind of see some of these connections. So we've got about a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back, and we will start again. Matt Liebman, you are up.